So questions and answers, please. Just wait until the microphone arrives at your floor.
Thank you. I was wanted to comment on Mr. Blake's new project on writing Churchill memorandum. I guess the counterfactual history opens many doors. That's the big problem. I wanted to ask your opinion, maybe China, Mr. Blake, or another historian on the table. What do you think of the claim that the Soviet Union was planning to attack Germany and the rest of Western Europe in the summer of 1941, as they had a lot of troops on the border and none of them in a defensive position? And there was complaints that there were special parachute planes that they were having. And if Hitler would have died in Prague or in any other way before 1939, how would that have changed? And do you think that the Second World War was unavoidable if Hitler was without this picture?
Okay. We're now speculating not on what Hitler We're speculating not now on what Hitler would have done in other circumstances, but on what Stalin would have done in other circumstances. And of course, I can't answer that fully. All I would say is that Stalin spent most of the late 1930s murdering virtually the whole of the Soviet general staff. And I'm not sure that the Soviet army was in any position to attack anyone. They did attack Finland, and they lost Finland. I found it unlikely that the Soviets would have been in any position to attack the Germans. The other thing about Stalin is that he was evil, but not mad. He was a highly rational dictator. And once you send your armies to war, it is highly likely that if you don't lose the war, you'll have some very successful generals. And we know that successful generals quite often do rather well in domestic politics afterwards. We know that Eisenhower, one of the most successful men of the Second World War, went on to become American president. Now, it's a fairly set pattern that a successful general will do something in civilian life. In a democratic state, of course, he can stand for election and win. In sort of like the Soviet state, the only thing a very successful general could have done would have been to challenge Stalin. And so I find it unlikely that Stalin was interested in waging aggressive war at any time. He fought the Second World War purely defensively until the end. And as I said, I don't think that the Soviets would have attacked. I could be wrong, I have no idea. I mean, Hitler might have dyed his hair green, Stalin might have joined the kibbutz, they might both have had early sex change operations. I don't know what would have happened in other circumstances, but I find it unlikely that they would have been Soviet attacks.
I might just very briefly add something to this. I've been reading the stuff on 1941, and I think it's a very far-fetched theory that Stalin was preparing to attack Hitler at that stage. I can think of almost no serious historian who accepts it. It was argued originally by Suvorov for very particular reasons, but really almost no one accepts it. You can explain the layout of the troops. It's entirely rational in Stalin's way of thinking. I think the idea of a preventive war in 1941 is excluded. Yes, they're preparing for something in 42 or 43, unquestionably, but not 41, I think.
This question is directed to Professor Wilson. I want to ask you, there's been a debate regarding the validity of fractional reserve banking in a free market. And one of the arguments in answer to the need for more money if the credit expansion sometimes saying we don't need more money. Whatever money we have right now does the job. There's fluctuations in demands of any kind. The prices fluctuate, not an increase or decrease purchasing power. And so therefore, we might argue that the optimal amount of money is what we have right now. And while I agree with the bargaining stance on the basic conclusions about fractions or banking in the free market, I would argue that that the statement that we have the optimal amount of money right now is not generally the case, or more specifically, that in a free market, money fluctuates in supply. It's because previous fluctuation of money supply increases. If we have a minting industry, that the supply of money will change because, in fact, the market demands that the supply of money changes, and therefore, just like with any other commodity, there is no such thing as an optimal amount, and in a free market, such a concept would dissolve. What do you think about it?
Well, that's a good question. The point is, thing that Rothbard made, and that I would also subscribe to, is that any of the money supply would be equally good. And so any money supply is equally optimal from an aggregate point of view. Now, of course, the question can be, how can we define the aggregate point of view? Is this the point of the question?
It would be if we had a free market, we had a minting industry,
yeah,
and mints are minting,
yeah,
could an Austrian stand up and say, there is an example, and could anyone else stand up and say, there is an example of market failure. We do not need this new money, and yet here we are.
I see. But that would be a wrong inference from the premise, right? The premise is, all whatever money supply is, it's equally good. So if it increases because you have minting and mining going on, then the new money supply isn't as good as the old one. It's not better. It's not worse either.
Yes, my questions concern Islam. I'll ask a few and make an observation. One is I read some papers published on the Winter Institute of RIBA, and I kind of have a question of how did the interpretation of RIBA as any amount of interest emerge? Because it seems, as an outsider, I'm not Muslim, when I read these papers, and it seems that it's very credible that the term RIBA or usury applies only to excessive amounts of interest or non-market rates, however you say that. And I have a follow-up as an American, that all the Muslims I know, of course, American, and I wonder, the Muslim entrepreneurs and businessmen that I know, how do Middle Eastern Muslims view them, or do they, if you're talking about rising awareness of Muslim entrepreneurs and businessmen, how are American Muslim entrepreneurs and businessmen viewed by Middle Eastern Muslims, or is that kind of a set for them?
Okay, well, I think the idea of interest as we understand in the modern world emerged in the modern era. Like in the Middle Ages, probably there wasn't a big difference. I mean, it was usually you lend someone lends you a lot of money and then gets 10 times of that or twice times of that. There's no idea of inflation, or there's no idea of an ongoing kind of process. So I think in the modern age, people start to see the difference more clearly, and this debate came up. In the medieval times, Muslims used these techniques. In for example, in the Ottoman Empire, the Sheikh of Islam, he allowed the pious foundations for some limited interest taking. So even in the Middle Ages, they saw a difference. But the issue became a big one in the modern age right now. And the solution some Muslims find is to have this non-interest banking, form of venture capital. You have those Islamic banks. In Turkey, we have if you're Islamic banks, but other banks are just normal banks, and just people go whatever they prefer to. And I think in a free market, you could have all these options, and so you don't need to design an Islamic economy or something. You want to have a free economy. If you're Islamic, it's like a kitchen, a part of it's kosher, eat the kosher, it's a big kitchen, sort of, I think, the concept. As how Muslims look at, well, it depends on which Muslims look at. I think the fact that the Muslims in the US are, the average Muslim in the US is quite different from the average Muslim in Europe, and I think that's an important difference. In the US, the Muslims, even the Turks, if you like take a flight to New York from Istanbul and a flight to Berlin, you will see that the ones going to New York are middle class professionals or PhD students and so on. The ones who go to Berlin go there to work in a, you know, like a Dora shop, and, you know, like a manual worker. And that's the case for most Muslim immigrants to Europe came as manual laborers. And the equivalent of that in the US would be Mexicans. Whereas like most Muslims who went to the US became middle class or upper middle class. So one reason that the US does not have the so-called Muslim issue that Europe has in the same equivalence. There are some radicalized Muslims within the US for a reaction to US foreign policy, but in the social level, you don't have the ghettoization and the feeling of alienation, I think, in the US society. And that's also maybe related with the tolerance towards, you know, religion in general in the US. But the idea of a Muslim businessman is not glorifying to many Muslims, but that was also always limited to a more classical, you know, like a shopkeeper kind of thing. But this idea of more Muslim businessman, more modern, entrepreneurial, investing a lot of money, as like, that's something new, and some people are criticizing it. And some more conservative thinkers in Turkey are saying that Turkish Muslims are being hedonistic, they're becoming consumerist. So there is an ongoing debate about the, you know, validity of a kind of a successful capitalist, you know, culture within Islam, and people have different ideas. Not necessarily a violent reaction, but there's criticism within Turkey itself from the more conservative side.
Again, if I could briefly add something, it's very striking in the 19th century that there are banks in the Ottoman Empire, and it was an awful lot of trade, but the banks are in the hands of the Armenians and Greeks. All I'm saying is that, you know, it's all very well saying that there is that tradition in Islam, but in the 19th century, when the Ottoman Empire was still very much on the trade routes, very much so, the bankers are Greeks or Armenians, or Levantines, that sort of thing. And the Turks and the Muslims have more or less dropped out of that world. It does need some explanation.
In the Ottoman Empire, non-Muslims became the bourgeoisie. And when they were expelled, or the Ottoman Empire lost them, or in an Armenian case, expelled tragically, then Turkey became a country without any bourgeoisie. Most Muslims were peasants or bureaucrats, because there was the idea of a veneration of state, that, you know, you should get into state and become a bureaucrat if you're not a peasant. So Turkey had an effort to create its own bourgeoisie with some, you know, with turning on a free market spirit. It was like a government-funded bourgeoisie, which we call the White Turks. They prospered under the ideology of the government. Now, the thing is, the conservative bourgeoisie coming from inland Turkey is coming from a more real underdog spirit. And they are the ones which we call the conservative Muslims right now. Whereas in the big cities in Istanbul, you would have the more westernized, you know, whiskey and, you know, like a cigar sort of businessman type. In Anatolia, you have the more mustache, and his wife goes to mosques, and he's making a lot of money, and says Prophet Muhammad was a merchant. And that's a new type in Turkey. And I think that's interesting for the history, for the rest of Islamic civilization, because this is more interesting. I mean, of course you can be a secular Muslim, and, you know, that's nice, but you're not very inspiring for most of the pious Muslim out there. But if you're religious, quite religious, but also if you engage in some things we call modern, then that's an interesting one.
Mustafa, question for you. Most religions except Islam, they have scriptures and they have God. And the position of God is that of an abstract principle in which there's a lot of space for creativity and changing your views and approach to things as time passes. But as you said, that in Islam, the Quran actually takes the place of the God, which is actually
of Jesus.
Okay, of Jesus. Okay, I'm not very good at doing this. I'm just trying to. Okay, let's say he takes the place of Jesus. Now, if you put Quran in such a high place, which is higher than the scriptures as it is in other religions, the thing is that you don't really leave any space for human creativity and independence there. My question is, comes back to the title of your speech, which is does Quran not make it takes over the place of capitalism because it replaces capitalism because it does not leave any space for creativity and freedom, so it does not really allow capitalism to take roots?
I disagree. The thing is, first of all, what I said in my speech is Quran is equivalent to the idea of Logos in the fourth gospel, as the word of God became flesh in the Muslim mind. But actually, that was debated in early medieval Islam. And there were two camps about the nature of the Quran. And one camp argued that the Quran is created, the other one said it is uncreated. And what this means is this. The created Quran camp said, it is the word of God, but God spoke it at a certain time in history, at a certain context. The other people said, no, it is uncreated in the sense that it was with God since eternity, and it came down to 7th century, as a block of word. I'm on the created Quran side, which says, it's word of God, but God spoke into a context. So and when God said, do this, I am according to that context and that culture and so on. So there is a different tradition which says, there's a tradition arising from this interpretation, which is the non-literalist interpretation. And even in the medieval era, there was Imam Shatibi who wrote the book about the maqasid, the purposes of the sharia. And he said, there are little rules of the law, but there are intentions of the law. And the intentions are eternal, whereas the details can change. And he noted those intentions as a protection of five principles, life, religion, the intellect, property, and progeny. So there is space for interpretation depending on how you look at the Quran itself. Plus, 90% of Islamic law is post-Quranic. The Quran covers a very little area. It generally gives basic principles. And so in most of the legal matters, you don't enter into any territory which is defined by the Quran. And even if you enter, again, there's this different interpretive tools. It's not that, it's a liberalism. Well, that's one line, of course.
Yes. Could I add something to that? If you are an Orthodox Christian, if you're an Orthodox Christian, or if you're a Roman Catholic, then yes, you believe that God spoke to man through the Bible, but also through the Church. The councils of the Church are also give the revealed Word of God. But if you're a Protestant, if you're one of the more thoroughgoing Protestants, you'll believe that the Bible is the inerrant, inspired Word of God, which is in itself sufficient for salvation. I wouldn't like to put this contrast between the Quran, which is a supreme document, and the Bible, which is not a supreme document. There are many shades within Christianity, and the particular shade of Christianity to which I come, which I don't necessarily subscribe, puts the Bible in much the same position as the Quran. So there's not that much difference.
It's still one of my prime topics for this distinguished panel. I have two questions. First of all, to Theo and Mustafa. Do you think that the instrument of sound credit, high market, and real savings can be entirely substituted by the instruments that the current interpretation of Islam allows, like Mubarawa, that is not having a straightforward time market, but where every capital transfer has to be a joint venture? In a way, so flourishing market economy possible without instrument of sound credit, at least in a straightforward way.
The second question is that Islam seems to offer a quite good basis for the criticism of paper money, which is not backed by commodities. Has this conception already reached the public debate in some Islamic countries?
I got the second question, but not the first one exactly. But can you reframe the first question?
Right. Is a flourishing market economy possible without straightforward credit, because it's not allowed by the current interpretation of Islam? Every capital transfer has to be a joint venture in a way, or it's a mask, or it's a commodity-based transaction. Do you think that's what Islamic economies might be lacking? It's instrument of sound credit, Guido has explained.
Okay, first of all, I don't believe in something called an Islamic economy. So there are people who believe in the Islamic economy, and they think that means that everything should be venture capital, no interest taking. And I think that system is hard to really sustain. In Malaysia, they're trying part of that, but there's a non-Muslim part of society, the Chinese, which are contributing to the economy, and there's no clear-cut example. But I personally think modern interest is not saving the usury, and many people think that way anyway. So I think it's a free economy, and Muslims would prefer that way, they can use it. And I think that interpretation will maybe be little and less popular as time goes by. In Turkey right now, for example, the majority of the society use normal banking, and only maybe a tiny percentage of society goes to those Islamic banks. And even those who go, who say, well, we don't see much difference actually, but at least to obey the clever law, we're doing this. I don't remember the second one was.
It's the criticism of paper money. Well,
there is that idea that the paper came as a novelty, and some people argue that. But I don't see any Islamic justification for paper money or gold standards or even gold itself. There are some people who made that argument. There are some people who say in Prophet's time there were no paper money, it was just gold and silver, but there was no cell phones in Prophet's time as well, or hotels and so on. So I don't think it's a rational argument. It's not a religious argument. And I think the problem in Islamic, in some of the interpreters or some of the scholars or authorities of Islam is that they think that religion defines everything. Putin doesn't define traffic laws, and if you want to extract traffic laws from the Quran, you really cannot from the Sharia. So it is actually much more limited. And of course, religious answers have been given to lots of questions in history, but they were actually human answers, inspired from religion, but given, after all, by human beings who were scholars who taught it within their context. And instead of just arguing what an Islamic economy should be, I would rather prefer to argue, there's no such thing. There are principles, there are values, but the implementation of those can change and vary over time. And that idea is also, becoming popular among some Muslims, and especially, I would say, in Turkey, in the more liberalist strain of Turkey.
You mentioned that the issue of fair money is violence against private property. Two persons may not own the same resource at one time. But according to Rothbard, in a libertarian society, even absorbing contracts would be possible. So, if one side of the contract agreed to be cheated from the side of bank, would be fractional reserves in the libertarian society prevalent from the point of view of the freedom of the contract?
I mean, of course, you can put your signature under any piece of nonsense. Right? You can write on a sheet of paper, I hereby agree that you are the king of China. I hereby think that I have invented a square circle or something. You can write such things and put your signature under this and then behave in a way that you think is fitting to this. But this has, of course, nothing to do with the problems that we confront in legal scholarship, in which we insist on the principle that a contract, in order to be valid and enforceable, must stipulate something that is possible. It's not possible that the same physical object, as you have pointed out, belongs to two persons at the same time. So, in practice, what would this mean? I think that, of course, in a free society, people are free to put their signature, again, under any nonsense that they might come up with. It's a different question whether they would find any court accepting this, and enforcing such types of contracts.
Well, that goes to the question of Islam and capitalism. I remember that 10 years ago, Barrow and McCleary published a comparative study about the relationship between economic performance and religious belief. And the outcome was more or less that every kind of religious belief in a moderate way promotes growth. Negative correlation is between religious fanaticism and economic growth, economic performance, which is quite obvious. On the other hand, said that, and I think that it's easy to explain it because every religion promotes certain values which are adapted and promote sound social relations. On the other hand, said that, I think that we have to distinguish between Islam and Christianity regarding the concept of revelation. Because if you there is a distinction between the Quran as the word as of God as such, and the Bible and the gospel containing the word of God. So I mean, you have four gospels with four different accounts of the history of Jesus. No? You have a lot of space of interpretation, and history shows that this, let's say, boundless or nearly boundless possibility to interpret the faith gave the possibility to the church to incorporate, for instance, the legal system of the Roman Empire, which was brought into the modern times. In the Islamic religion, I think that these boundaries are much more narrow. So the space for interpretation is much narrower. I don't want to say that it has not been, that there was no attempt to go beyond this. Islamic enlightenment in the medieval time or something like this, and the Turkish history, the Ottoman history shows that as well. But the conclusion would be that Islam is the more efficient in the economic, from the economic point of view, the more it is heretic.
More so.
Heretic.
I'm leaving out the last thing. Is it a heretical idea of Islam that you choose?
Excuse me?
What was your emphasis on the idea of heretic? I didn't get that.
To go beyond the orthodoxy of understanding of the Quran. So it needs to go beyond the orthodoxy of the understanding of the of Quran to be efficient.
Well, first of all, I agree with you that Islam, it's wrong to compare Islam to Christianity. There are important differences. If we really need a parallelism between any of those big religions, Islam is closer to Judaism than Christianity, with its emphasis on law, with its very strong monotheism and its rejection of the doctrine of Trinity in the theological sense. Maybe the first five books of the Torah can be then compared to the Quran as the ultimate revelation which God gave to Moses. And Moses is similar to Muhammad, certainly Muhammad than Jesus is, even in his message and in the way that Muslims and including Jews and Christians understand them. And actually, maybe today the historical experience of Islam is a bit like the historical experience of Jews when they first faced enlightenment and modernity. So you had different, you had a reformation in the sense that some remain Orthodox, some became conservative, you even had a reformed Judaism. Probably something like that will happen to Islam, maybe is happening right now already. And some people even have argued that the Muslim position vis-a-vis the West is a bit like the Jewish position vis-a-vis Rome 2,000 years ago, in the sense that they had a Herod, the dictators, and installed by Rome, and they were fighting, and there were different reactions, zealots and Pharisees and so on, and that's an interesting argument. But to come back to your point, do we need a heretical position on the Orthodoxy to, move on with something like this? I would not say heretical, because those are already in the tradition. But yes, there is some need of a renewal, a revival within the Sunni tradition. Because the Sunni Orthodoxy has been formed in the 2nd, 3rd century in a specific context, in a specific, environment. And those the interpretations of those scholars, the earliest scholars, became unquestionable norms. And actually there's an effort to question them since the late 19th century. Late 19th century Muslim liberals from the Ottoman Empire or Egypt or from the Arab world, Afghani in the Arab world, or Abduk in the Ottoman Empire, people like Naam Kemal, they said much of the things which are in the West, like freedom and free markets and economy and progress and rule of law and constitution, they said are actually compatible with our core values, but we got buried in time. That was their argument. The problem is that in the 20th century, because of the confrontation with the West, many Muslims just were pushed to the other side. They became communists or socialists. Simply, they were fighting the West, and they thought this is a way to resist the West. If the Western world leaves it a little bit, I think there is room and there are sources within the tradition itself to come back with some of the liberal ideas. And it is not an accident that in the turn of the 20th century, all prominent Muslim thinkers were liberals who said the West has great things and we should learn from them. You just roll back to the 1930s and you find many of the people who replaced them becoming more and more strident against the West, because they lost the caliphate, they were colonized, and they saw all those Western intrusion in their countries, and West became the enemy rather than a successful model you can learn from. And I think in countries that you did not have the same experience, in Turkey, Malaysia, you are actually seeing it something different. You should not expect a liberal Islamic strain to come from Gaza when it's under occupation. They're fighting, and that's the only thing they know. Or from tribal areas in Pakistan, which has no access to anything which is modern. But from places which you have a Muslim society which is modernizing in its own way. And that should be allowed. The problem is that was not always allowed, either by the West or by secular dictators, who said all should be trashed out and we should totally become French wannabes, and that's it. That was another, the model of Turkey wasn't like that.
This is to Mustafa as well as a comment from Leo. Recently, the finance minister of Malaysia called for gold dinar, but also he called for this to be the unit of account and the unit of settlement in their international trade.
Count, I'm sorry?
The unit of account as well as the unit of settlement for their international trade. And he made this suggestion to the Organization of Islamic Nations that they adopt this kind of thing. My question to you is whether you think this has any traction, whether you think this has any potential in the Islamic world. And Guido and Olivier, I'd like to ask a comment as to what do you think would happen if such a thing might occur.
Well, I'll be brief on this. I don't think so that much. At least from my experience in Turkey, that's not a big debate or an issue here in the Islamic community in Turkey. Pro-
in there with people who would theoretically argue with that, but also places like Turkey is so integrated into the Western or the global economy that instead of initiating such a radical change, they would probably adopt to what is already out there. So I think, well, that's an interesting idea, but I don't see it very likely to, you know, become the view, the dominant view, all across the board. Maybe some Muslims would support that. But
what would be the likely effect? Well, one effect would be that there would be a stronger incentive for investors all over the world to hold at least part of their portfolios in such countries that benefit from such a currency, because as a medium of reserve, it's far superior to Western paper currencies. So this would be beneficial for savers all over the world, and would benefit those countries because of the stronger capital inflows.
And it would become a unit of account against which the dollar could be a benchmark to the euro, whereas now euro is really benchmarked against the dollar, and they both get money, so when they both devalue together, nobody notices. So I do think that there will be also a psychological effect which would come out of the Islamic sphere, so it could be on that.
My question is for Sean Gap. I was a little bit surprised to hear George Orwell conceptualize the West of democracy. I know he called himself a socialist, but his novels all seem to me like very strong repudiations of state power. I'm curious to hear a little bit more from your perspective.
There is more than one George Orwell. There's more than one George Orwell. There's the Orwell at the end of his life who reacted against socialist totalitarianism, or perhaps just reacted against totalitarianism. But there's also the younger Orwell of the 1930s who was a state socialist. If you read The Road to Within here, it doesn't really talk much about self-sufficiency and independence. It's not a left anarchist tract. Orwell was, in the 30s, very much touched by state socialism. Now, of course, Orwell, to some extent, recanted at the end of life, and who is J.B. Priestley, retracted a lot of socialism in old age. Malcolm Muggeridge, whom I didn't mention, became quite a strong anti-socialist. And it is possible that many of the socialist figures of the 1930s and 40s would have grown out of it if it had not been encouraged by circumstances. Going back to a question, I think Orwell must, in 1930s at least, be regarded as part of the state socialist left.
I'm actually very impressed by Mustafa's discussion about the similarities between Judaism and Islam. He's perfectly right. I mean, in terms of the legal content of the Elijah, they're almost identical. I was also impressed by Sean's comment that the Bible is treated within certainly the Protestant Christianity, really as the Word of God in the same way the Quran is. And one might also point to the fact that Christians, Jews in the West had prohibitions every bit as strict against interest as we find in the Muslim world. The first prominent Christian theologian who made a distinction between commercial loans and loans for human need, trying to elucidate the passage of Deuteronomy against increase at the expense of your neighbors, Calvin, and then others in the 16th century afterwards, including some Jesuits, began to make these distinctions. So you can find a very similar history of restriction. And in some ways, the Muslim notion of Hatawi, the way you sort of create a kind of means, or almost use a subterfuge, some sort of means by which you can carry out a loan, and very often you don't look at the recipient and so forth, it's just a kind of blank loan. And so this is really developed in the Muslim world and then taken over by Christians later. But having said all these things, why is it that Muslims do not make the sort of leap in the 18th century?
entry into a kind of modern capitalist economy, which people do in the West. I would also add the fact that the Jewish situation is different, because although they are very similar to the Muslim, they're talking about very small communities, which can then be brought into the West and westernized, something which may be similar to the situation of Muslims in the United States. So if you're dealing with small numbers, perhaps it is easier to westernize them, as opposed to people living in a society with tens of millions of people who are held together by these legal restrictions. In any case, I sort of throw my question open to everyone, anyone who cares to answer. Why does the Muslim world not make that sort of leap into economic modernization that you find being made by Christians and Jews?
Sorry, I don't want to jump the gun, but I've got something I hope that's of some interest. I mean, you could surely ask the same question about the Catholic world if you're talking about the 18th century. But again, you know, you're right to say that the Christian world was hostile to interest. But it's quite an interesting thing that after the Counter-Reformation, it's the church and the monasteries which take over that institution which we all know in the Protestant world, the pawn shop, definitely. And they call it, in all Latin languages, it is called Mount of Piety, because it was taken over, that thing was taken over by the church. And you find this extraordinary thing with the entrepreneur of Italy, or Catholic Belgium, or France as well, all go to Protestant countries, and the Protestant countries are the ones who take off, whereas a very large part of Catholic Europe languishes for a very long time. And there is that parallel with what happened with Islam. And it is specifically, again, Mediterranean. Perhaps it is to do simply with the fact that there's no air conditioning.
If I could supplement what Professor Stone has said, I don't think it's at all fair to say that Christendom in the 18th century jumped into modernity, whereas Islam lagged behind. The jump into modernity happened in Britain, it happened in Holland, and to a much lesser extent in France. It didn't happen in many other places. The Catholic world was largely left behind, certainly Spain was. And once you look into the Orthodox world in Russia, it was in at least as lagging a position as Islam. So rather than ask, you know, why is Islam lagging behind? The point is that all of humanity lagged behind Britain, Holland, and to some extent France. Those are the exceptions. Islam is not the exception at all. Islam fits in remarkably well with the general pattern of human civilization. A bit better than some, a bit worse than others, but neither particularly good nor bad. The exception is those three Atlantic states from perhaps the early or the middle of the 17th century onwards.
Well, I very much agree with both of the comments. The question is how the West made progress, whereas, you know, Islam was just going its own way. But here's the question. The West, the Northern Europe basically created modernity. And others started to catch up. I mean, Japan obviously did. And now China is in a bizarre way, but doing it to some decent capitalist system. Now, Muslims can, I think, do the same thing. And there are examples, as I said. There's no single Muslim world. Like, look at Turkey, Malaysia, Dubai. These are actually promising examples. But I think in the Muslim mind, there's one conceptual issue, and that is to learn from the ways of the ones who think who are actually theologically wrong. I mean, to the infidels, the others, who are not blessed with the revelation you have, from the Muslim point of view, totally. How do you accept the fact that they have done really well in something, and then take it from them, and still feel loyal and proud of your tradition? And that's a question I think many Muslims have been struggling through the 19th century. And this becomes worse when the other, the successful other, is also your enemy.
in the sense that its policy is hurt you. It's a rival. Its policy is intimidating. Mm-hmm. That's why I think, you know, the Arab world became a Soviet ally, mainly most of it in the 20th century. Soviet atheism is much less friendly to Islam than, you know, liberal European societies, or even the theism in the Christian Europe. But they were forced to, you know, the political confrontation makes it, I think, harder to accept something. You want to be the exact opposite of it. You want to defy them and reject them and so on. And that's about psychology. But also, some of the policies of the West also sometimes exacerbate that psychology in this part of the world.
Okay, we have six people waiting to speak, and we have
only 10 minutes.
10 minutes, just to give you a second.
So the topic I'd like to put in front of now is Novelist Blake's potential next book, which you may greatly enhance this reputation. Each member of the panel has something to say about the context that might be in Novelist Blake's next book. The triggering event for counterfactual history might not be as neat as a motor accident in Prague in 1939. But let's suppose that the stupid hubris of Britain in entering into the First World War did not happen from some concocted event for Novelist Blake's next novel. And the topics that might be addressed in this novel include not only no entry of Britain in barless slaughter, barless conflict in what started as the First World War. And to that, the United States doesn't enter the First World War. And to that, that the Bolshevik Revolution does not happen. And to that, we do not have the slavery of Germany under the Treaty of Versailles. And to that, we therefore don't have the Weimar hyperinflation. Add to that, because we do not have the status of blowout of the First World War, that the central power of the central banks is less enhanced. Add to that, then we do not have the fiat money boom of the 20s, nor do we have the Great Depression, nor do we have the rise of Hitler, nor do we have, therefore, the Second World War. Now, isn't this a topic that perhaps Blake should consider as his next novel? And I'd like each member of the panel has something to say about this, especially certain members of the panel, as a counterfactual for the 20th century history. And indeed, perhaps the Nobel Prize in Economics would be a libertarian prize rather than a prize for the next sophistication in state intervention in the economy.
Let me talk very briefly. I agree that the First World War, the Great War, was the great catastrophe of the 20th century. However, once you try to write fiction in an alternative world where the First World War didn't happen, it does become extremely difficult because our thoughts, the words we use, the things we use, all the things around us have been determined by events that did happen after 1914. And to conceive a world in 2014 where the Great War didn't break out is not impossible. A better novelist than Richard Blake could say, but it's beyond Richard Blake's power. To give a brief example, it's difficult to imagine that the internet would not have evolved in this parallel world. What would we call the internet? That is an American word. And it's unlikely that America would have been quite so dominant in technology without the destruction of Germany. So for that reason alone, Richard Blake decided not to go for a world in which the Great War hadn't happened. It's much easier to extrapolate 20 years ahead from 1940 than to extrapolate 100 years ahead from 1940.
I want to add one important topic. Without
that, can I just interrupt? Yeah. With Hans,
I suggest that if they want Nikolai and Hunt answer, or give their comment if they want, because they haven't had a question proposed, and after that we will have to stop.
Anyone on the panel comment on this question, and then we close.
Well, one problem in this counterfactual history seems to be the assumption that the counterfactual of a government intervention is the lack of any government intervention. So we can very well imagine that the lack of that the counterfactual to wars and the government intervention that we saw would have been other interventions. And as a matter of fact, this is what we could logically suppose to a given extent. Knowing that there is at the beginning something like a government and that its nature and tendency is to expand. On the libertarian prizes, as a matter of fact, there are a number of libertarian prizes by the Ludwig von Mises Institute in Auburn. But the matter fact there is that these prizes are quite clear what they are about. They are about libertarianism and Austrian economics. They do not claim to be prizes about economics in general. So they do not hide their ideological bias, quite to the contrary.
Well, Mike, is that on? Hello?
Thank you.
Well, I mean, with these counterfactual kinds of things, one of my comments would be that so many of the issues that we think of as arising in World War I were really well entrained before the war started. It seemed to accelerate these kinds of things, but they were already existent. So, you might imagine things sort of rolling out a little bit differently, but it might be surprising how many kinds of patterns and so forth would remain the same. I mean, I think about these issues to do with Iran, since I've been thinking about this a lot, and you know, some of these patterns were there kind of irrespective of World War One, and it kind of altered the thing, but you know, it's almost like the Marxist view of Hitler, if not Hitler, then somebody else to fill that role in the Marxist kind of interpretation. And you know, in that sense, I think that's a real possibility. But who knows?
Does anybody else on the panel want to comment? Anybody on the panel want to comment on this one? First of all, okay. In that case, I thank you all, and please keep in mind that we are very much in a hurry to get the photos done and then load the buses to go out for dinner. So please change your addresses.
Oh, you're going to get